You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 30th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. And joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hello, everyone.
Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
And Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Rebecca is feeling a little under the weather this evening, so she unfortunately cannot join us tonight, but she will definitely be back next week. So get better, Rebecca.
Feel better. Do you guys know what happened 1,002 years ago today?
1,002 years ago, that would be 1,006.
Right.
I have no idea.
It rings a bell.
Supernova SN1006, the brightest supernova in recorded history, appears in the constellation Lupus.
Is that the one seen by the Chinese? Some Chinese scholars made note of it. Was that that one? 1006?
Okay, this supernova was widely seen on Earth beginning in the year 1006 AD, when Earth was about 7,200 light years away from the supernova. It was the brightest apparent magnitude stellar event in recorded history, first appearing in the constellation Lupus on April 30th, and it was described by observers in Switzerland, Egypt, Iraq, China, Japan, and North America.
Wow.
That's intense.
Cool. We have an interview coming up later in the show with Kirsten Sanford, who's from This Week in Science podcast and also a fellow skeptologist. But first, some news items. In Baltimore County, Maryland, the police and experts have been baffled, I tell you, by an unexplainable phenomenon. Evan, tell us about it.
Okay, so this took place just a couple of nights ago. It was as it was first reported. People woke up in the middle of the early morning to a very loud booming sound, as it's described, or one might say an explosion.
Like a gunshot, some people.
And a flash of light. Really, it woke several hundred people. Calls were made to 911 all over the place. And also, apparently, this phenomenon has been occurring regularly on and off for several weeks, as some people reported. One person said, "The bedroom actually lights up like the day. It's instantaneous and wakes us up out of a very deep sleep." And people didn't know what it was. And the police, the local television station, went down to interview the police, who actually were able to catch the flash and audio recording of the boom on tape, and they investigated it, and they said they had absolutely no idea what it was. They were stunned, and they were hoping an expert would step forward and help them solve the mystery.
Now, we'll have the link to these original news stories, which also has the video from several TV news reports on this. I do recommend, if you're able to do this, look at it before you listen to the rest of our discussion and see if you can figure out what this is, but because we're going to tell you what the answer is in a moment. So if you want to have the opportunity to figure out yourself, watch the news reports before you listen to the rest of our discussion.
In the meantime, I'll tell you what a few of the people who commented on this particular news story had to say about it, some things that they were just throwing out there as possibilities. One person said, very dry and limestone dust gets into wires, and you can actually see St. Elmo's fire build up on the wires and then drop and explode. Another person suggested perhaps it's some kind of military or government bomb testing. "You know how the military is." That's a direct quote.
What does that mean? Yeah, they bomb civilian areas all the time.
Another person suggested that perhaps it was the result of event horizons or rifts in time due to experimentations and time travel from a date in the future. When the test is successful, then you will see an object or someone from the future.
It's obviously... Terminator being sent from the future.
Yeah.
Come on.
A whole bunch of them, apparently.
That's exactly what it will look like. Is that a coincidence? Come on.
No, not
okay,
a coincidence.
Here's my guess. I just quickly forwarded through the video. My first guess would be it's a prank.
With a prankster with M80s?
Yeah.
That was my thought too.
Okay.
You got to watch this video. It's amazing. The police officer saying, "Well, we ruled out lightning and electrical discharges from the telephone poles and gas leaks, and we can't figure it out. We have we're baffled." They get this poor sucker, Johns Hopkins scientist to watch the video, and he can't figure it out. I say, "Well, something is definitely happening, but I don't know what it is." They play it up into this huge mystery, and I'm like, come on, It's explosions. Yeah. Have you people never seen an M80 going off?
Or a
off?
Quarter stick of dynamite or something like that.
Come on. It was so simple. It was amazing how they turned this little prank into this incredible mystery and went through all these convoluted explanations, making it much more complicated than it was. And they really hadn't addressed directly the simplest explanation for what this is.
So it was kids blowing off some fireworks.
Well, it didn't take long for the mystery to be solved, and it was solved just a day or so later. When the police repositioned a couple of the cameras and were able to target in a little more accurately on the explosion, and they were able to catch a suspect who they arrested. The fellow's name was
Saul Rosenberg. It went off like a firecracker.
His name is 59-year-old Fred Mackler. And apparently what he was doing is they don't know exactly what kind of explosive he was using, but he was setting off an explosive, probably a quarter stick of dynamite or something. And apparently he was disgruntled about having to do with other people in his apartment complex, and to exact some sort of revenge on them, he decided that he would wake up, you know, every morning or almost every morning and light off a large explosive and wake everyone up and disturb their sleep. So he has since been
a disgruntled neighbor.
Mm-hmm. And he's since been arrested on, they found drugs and they found fireworks, illegal fireworks, I guess, in his apartment and other things. He's being held on several charges and the mystery is over.
The inability to explain something doesn't mean that it's inexplicable. You know, always consider the simplest things first.
Yes.
It is difficult to reverse engineer, if you will, what something, you know, could be from, because there's so many quirky little possibilities.
Right.
This also reminds me of another similar story where there was a UFO sighting and, you know, dozens of people saw mm-hmm. it from over a wide area and nobody could figure yep. out what it was. And it turns out that it was a paper, like Zeppelin, like a model Zeppelin that had caught fire. So it was sort of floating high in the sky and burning for a few minutes on fire.
Oh, the humanity.
Right. Nobody, and the only reason why we know that that's what it was because the person who had launched it and set it on fire confessed and resolved the mystery. But if that person had never confessed, right. who could really have figured out what that was based upon the description of the sightings, or even if it were videotaped from a distance, you would still probably not be able to figure right. that out. The inability to explain it doesn't mean that it has to be something fantastical or alien or that it's unexplainable.
To wrap this up, someone else suggested that they were thinking that maybe the authorities should contact Marianne Winkowski, thinking perhaps it was a ghost. And Marianne uh-huh. Winkowski is mm-hmm. a ghost hunter of sorts. She speaks with you know, the dead and whatnot, and is the subject of the show Ghost Whisper from CBS.
Oh, it's too bad they didn't get in touch with her before it was solved to see if she would commit herself on something. If she was smart, she wouldn't commit herself to something so physical that could actually have an explanation. But it would have been interesting. Okay, well, the next news item is a follow-up on the academic freedom laws that are being pushed in several states in the United States, and one in Florida. And last week, the Florida State Senate passed their version of this so-called Evolution Academic Freedom Act. What these bills are designed to do is to essentially contain some language protecting the teaching or the expression of belief in creationism in public schools. So here's, for example, the language from this bill. Every public school teacher in the state's K-12 school system shall have the affirmative right and freedom to objectively present scientific information relevant to the full range of scientific views regarding biological and chemical evolution in connection with teaching any prescribed curriculum regarding chemical or biological evolution. Public school students in the state's K-12 school system shall be evaluated based upon their understanding of course materials through normal testing procedures. However, students shall not be penalized for subscribing to a particular position or view regarding biological or chemical evolution. Therefore, teachers cannot be acted against if they teach criticism of evolution. It doesn't say that they can teach creationism or intelligent design. Basically, it means that they could, you know, present pseudoscientific criticism of evolution. And students can profess not to believe in evolution and not be graded upon negatively based upon that belief. This is all a backdoor effort to get intelligent design in the classroom, or at the very least hamper the teaching of evolution in the classroom under the guise of academic freedom. Again, this is the strategy of the intelligent design proponents, the Discovery Institute. This is what Expelled is all, the movie is all about, academic freedom. It's all a deception. It is not what this is really about.
It's a pure attack on science is what it is.
It absolutely is. Again, what they miss is, you know, they miss a lot of things, but one of the key things they miss in this respect is that this is not about academic freedom, but academic quality and standards. You can't have standards and have absolute freedom at the same time. Those two things are completely at odds. You have to have a balance. But just by championing, quote-unquote, freedom, they're neglecting the whole aspect of academia requires that there's a certain amount of a standard
or
quality
next?
Control.
Are teachers allowed to have the freedom to suggest that 2 plus 2 is perhaps 5 in math classes? It's the equivalent of that. It makes no sense.
Yeah, or HIV denial or
Holocaust denial.
You name it. I mean, they could basically teach anything that they want and under the guise of freedom. This law would protect them. Although this one, though, specifically refers to evolution. So and the language had been changed, had gone through some revision. So I think there was some moderation of the language in this bill. And the one that has gone through the Senate did specifically refer to chemical and biological evolution. Of course, that's the topic that they're interested in. So it's actually, from that perspective, you could say that they're being hypocritical. You know, why single out evolution?
Right.
You know?
So, Steve, is anybody moving against this?
What do you mean? Yeah, I mean, there's definitely scientists and the National Center for Science Education, and there are definitely groups that are opposing this. More moderates, politically are trying to do so. But it's these kind of laws are gaining traction in Florida, in Texas, and other southern states.
The biggest textbook,
right?
And as far as why are they targeting evolution? Well, perhaps it's because it conflicts with some things that are written down in the Bible. Just maybe,
right? Because that's what it is. Because evolution is evolution, and I think it's responsible for the moral decay of the world. The Holocaust and all everything that ills the world. That's their boogeyman. So that's what they care about. They don't give a rat's patootie about academic freedom. I don't think they even know what it really means and how to think about it meaningfully. It's just a banner under which they are pushing this ideological agenda.
It's the latest tactic.
It's a tactic. It's absolutely a tactic. It's a deliberate one as well. I actually blogged about this last week, and I compared it to the healthcare freedom laws, which is exactly the same thing. In this country, again, state by state, in the dead of night, under the radar, people are pushing for these so-called healthcare freedom laws, and it's the same thing. They're eliminating the standard of care, the mechanism by which the states uphold a standard of medical care under the guise of healthcare freedom. So, same exact strategy that is now being adapted to attacks on teaching evolution.
It's working.
The promotion of intelligent design.
What do you think will happen, Steve?
I think that these laws will pass in some states, and it'll be challenged at some point, work its way up to the Supreme Court, and then we'll see what happens. It depends on who's sitting on the Supreme Court when it gets there, unfortunately. There's one other tiny aspect of this. Maybe it's not so tiny. And this is a point where I actually find myself in disagreement with some fellow skeptics. The one part of the law where it talks about students being graded on the standard testing and not upon their professed position regarding evolution. There's actually some legitimacy to that. I'm referring in part to a blog entry written by Larry Moran, who writes the Sandwalk blog, which is a skeptical scientific blog. And he wrote a few weeks ago, "This is one of the reasons why I would flunk them if they took biology and still rejected the core scientific beliefs. It's not good enough to just be able to mouth the acceptable version of the truth that the professor wants. You actually have to open your mind to the possibility that science is correct and get an education. That's what university is all about." So I definitely understand that principle. I understand where it's coming from. But in practice, what he's saying is that if a student learns evolutionary theory is able to, you know, to demonstrate that they understand it, but still professes not to believe it, that he would flunk them on that basis, even though he passed all the exams. And I don't know. I think that's crossing a line that we don't want to cross for a number of reasons. One, it kind of puts us into the business of assessing people's beliefs. And I don't think that we should do that. Again, we've always sort of preached that science and skepticism is about the method, not about the belief. We don't care what people believe. You just have to use consistent logic and, you know, fairly assess all the evidence and be legitimate in how you go about arguing things. But at the end of the day, what you believe in your heart of hearts is just personal and up to you, and who cares? And honestly, if a student can not only, I think we could solve the problem that Larry Moran is getting at by saying, you know, it's more, students have to do more than just regurgitate dry facts, right? If they could demonstrate that they actually understand evolutionary theory, that they can argue it, that they understand the lines of evidence for it and why those lines of evidence are compelling. If they could do all of that and still somehow profess belief in creation and or doubt of evolution, you know, really, who cares? Then they've accomplished the only goal,
right?
That the education system to really have for them, that they learn the material and they really understand it. They didn't just memorize facts; they understand concepts.
Right. Now, Steve, I agree that if they show true understanding, then you don't you can give them a pass grade. But when you say who cares, I mean, I'll tell you who cares. I mean, how about prospective employers? If I was hiring somebody that knows it all and understands it all but still doesn't believe it, I would not hire them if their job relied on that information.
Yeah, but you know, does it really matter if the student believes in a theory or can express understanding of the theory?
Right. That's the debate. You know, Is it proper to ask the student, you know, do you accept that the evidence supports, you know, evolution? And I do think it absolutely says something about that student if they say no, if they don't believe that natural selection and mutations, whatever, are responsible for evolution.
That's a slippery slope, though, Steve.
But it is. But it may be saying something about their religious beliefs, not about their scientific understanding. And then that's where I think you cross that fuzzy line. So now we're actually discriminating against belief. And you can definitely, Bob, if you were hiring somebody and it was a private firm and you want to use that as a criterion to sort of gauge whatever you're looking for in your employees, you have the right to do that. I think that that's fine. But I don't think that in the public, especially the public school system, that we can do that, that we can start asking people about their beliefs. I think we need to require of them that they demonstrate understanding. If for no other reason that it opens us up to this kind of thing, these kind of laws, because then it gives them the legitimacy to say, see, we have to protect the rights of our students against, you know, the atheistic agenda of these scientists. I have no problem with skeptics and scientists who are openly atheistic and who promote both. That's their right. They could do whatever they want. But I don't think that you can require students to be atheists in order to pass them. That's ridiculous. Any sort of litmus test of belief, I think, is equivalent to that, in my opinion. But we'll probably get emails about that because this is actually a very touchy area. And there's a lot of internal debate going on right now within, you know, the skeptical movement about that very thing. And in some corners, it's gotten quite,
you know, it's
nasty.
Easy. This is one of those things where it's easy to just go with the idea that as a skeptic, yeah, I want people to believe in evolution. And you want them to not just understand it, but you want them to back it up and support it. But I don't know. I have a hard time agreeing with this. I have a hard time making people you know, the information that they would say on a test, they answer something and they give correct answers. What's the difference between that and them? What if it's a history test? Well, I don't 100% agree that the Boston Tea Party went down like that because of this, this, and this, but this is the answer I know the teacher wants, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Right, yeah. Where do you draw that line? And also, the other thing is, I really think that if you design the test in such a way, like, give them essay questions, you know, and have them demonstrate that they actually understand why irreducible complexity is not a legitimate criticism of evolutionary theory.
Yeah,
and really demonstrate that they understand.
Right.
That.
If you get them to memorize that, maybe they'll really start thinking and be like, "Wait, yeah, I understand this." And wait, well, it's starting to make sense,
Bob,
to me.
A good teacher really does inspire their students to think. You know, it isn't just reciting facts. It's helping them work through the logic and understand it. So I totally agree with a teacher putting the effort into making them think.
Yeah. Because honestly, I don't know of any intelligent design proponent or creationist who can do that.
Right, yeah.
Who can talk the talk. You know what I mean? So I think that actually stays within the bounds and accomplishes everything we want to accomplish and avoids this kind of nonsense. The next news item has to do with Gary Null. Now, Gary Null is definitely on my short list as one of the most evil, slimy con artists out there. This guy has been active for years, basically attacking the health of the public in order to line his own pockets. This guy's all about supplements and so-called, you know, natural living. He endorses every crackpot medical idea that can make him money. He tells people with serious illnesses that they shouldn't, you know, be partaking in mainstream medicine, but instead should just be buying his products and his nonsense. And now he, adding to his list of malfeasance, adding to his anti-vaccinationist nonsense and his snake oil, he just now produced a documentary claiming that HIV does not cause AIDS. So now he's also an HIV denier. Gary Null is very much in the vein of Kevin Trudeau, another sort of snake oil salesman who's made a lot of money because they, you know, they get their shtick down, they know they press all the right buttons, they, you know, wrap it up in a nice conspiracy theory to stave off any criticism from us evil doctors, and there you go. This is the kind of thing that really disgusts me.
We need laws against these people.
These kind of people, because they're using pseudoscience to hurt people's health to make money. I mean, it doesn't get more evil than that in my book. But the only thing that, you know, does give me a little bit of satisfaction is when you have a crank pseudoscientist like Gary Null, and then he piles on the nonsense to such a degree. You know, it's like when you endorse all different kinds of pseudoscience, it kind of makes my point for me. It's like, yeah, this guy is a crank. Not only if he's honest, he's a crank. If he's dishonest, he's just a con artist. But and all of his natural food crap, you know, it puts it into a nice perspective when he's also an HIV denier, you know, and he's also an anti-vaccinationist. It makes it a little bit easier to make the case that this guy
and
really
in the
is
worst
full
ways,
of.
Steve. I mean, HIV denial is just really it's the end of that spectrum that, you know, really just, I don't know, makes me sick in my stomach.
You do not care about killing people when you tell people with AIDS, do not take your anti-HIV drugs, because it's a lie. So think about that. This guy, Gary Null, either he is so misinformed.
That's possible.
And deluded. Right. It's possible, but he's too slick for that. In my opinion, this is my opinion, he's too slick for that. I've seen this, you know, up and down the spectrum. I think he's at the Kevin Trudeau end of the spectrum. I think it's more likely that he doesn't believe it for a minute. And if that's true, that means he doesn't care about killing people in order to make money, about having people not get proper treatment for a life-threatening illness.
You know, the thing is, when you go to his website, the whole site is about making money. It isn't about sharing information. It's all about making money. It's very obvious if you go there.
All pathways lead to giving him money for his stuff. You could live forever. He says that. You could follow my health program to live forever.
So many products. I mean, you can't even follow all this stuff. Plus, he has a program called 7 Steps to Perfect Health. Perfect health? Hello?
Yeah.
Hyperbole.
Oh, I mean, I love it when you know, mainstream medicine critics say, our doctors are always promising things they can't deliver. Really? We are? In fact, we don't do that. It's unethical. It's right there in pretty much every state's ethical guidelines that you can't do that. But they have the nerve to do that. And then the gurus that they promote say things like this, the pathway to perfect health. I remember I was emailed by someone defending the claims of Hulda Clark. He said, oh, yeah, he's criticizing you doctors for claiming things you can't do. You're always, you know, making claims that aren't supported, you know, by the evidence. And I pointed out to him, I said, the title of the book of the woman that you're defending is The Cure for All Disease. I mean,
wow.
Doesn't this cause you even the slightest bit of cognitive dissonance? Come on.
What do you say to that?
Nothing coherent. I mean, what could he say? Just goes off on some other tangent about, you know, the evils of modern medicine.
Non sequitur.
Yeah, but Steve, he's in good shape. I mean, the guy's Diesel, you know? How can you not believe him?
Right.
Yeah, right.
So is Jack LaLanne. That's a guy who, what is a guy, like a million years old now?
And that's have perfect
eat,
genes.
Right, and exercise.
Yeah, and have perfect.
Good old-fashioned Jack LaLanne. And there's always that. I mean, you have to be lucky, too. But that guy's in great shape. He's been in great shape
his
whole life.
He's the real deal. That guy is no joke.
He's the real deal. That's what I'm saying. No BS. He's not selling a million things as far as I know. I've never seen that he is. Yeah, but he spent a lifetime promoting a healthy diet and regular exercise. He's extremely old and incredibly healthy.
I think he sells unitards.
Is that right? Well, Bob, changing gears a little bit, you have a report for us on the real Iron Man in honor of the upcoming Iron Man movie.
Yeah, on a lighter note.
Are you saying this is based on a true story? Is that what I'm getting here?
No, come on.
You know, it's coming in. We're taping it on Wednesday, a couple days before it comes out. I'm going to see it opening night. I'm really psyched to see it, even though I've never read any of the Iron Man comics. But any self-respecting geek should love the idea of a wearable exoskeleton suit that turns the user into pretty much a superhero. I mean, who wouldn't love that? I haven't seen the movie, but the preview looks awesome. But the exosuit is really the star of the show of this movie. It really is. I've really been into the idea of an exosuit like this for 20 years. I remember seeing a picture of one that the military was working on. I was like, wow, that's awesome. Then I read Heinlein's 1959 novel Starship Troopers, where he first hear about this exosuit that I've come across. I believe he was the first guy to popularize it. So what's the reality? What's really going on? How close are we actually to a real Iron Man suit? There's actually a bunch of powered exoskeleton suits in development and in various stages of readiness, but my favorite is the result of a $75 million DARPA program called Exoskeletons for Human Performance Augmentation. Now, three teams were involved in the project, but only one, the Sarcos team, has advanced to the next stage. Sarcos is a robotics manufacturer and a division of defense contractor Raytheon. Their suit is called XOS, which I guess is short for exoskeleton. Now, if Iron Man had Tony Stark, the mad genius behind XOS is Uber robotics engineer Steve Jacobson. He's like one of my new heroes. This guy is totally amazing. He and his engineers have created the most capable exosuit yet. The idea behind their suit was to create a mechanical shadow for a person.
Meaning that the suit moves exactly the way you do.
Yeah, the idea was to create a mechanical shadow for the person, so every move you make is perfectly mimicked by the exoskeleton. Now, this requires sensors sampling and analyzing the host's movement hundreds, even thousands of times a second. Now, the goal, as Jacobson said, is to stay in light contact with the wearer, but never get out of contact. So it's important, it's really important to offer no resistance. Imagine you're like enmeshed in this mechanical suit, and you're moving and it's moving with you. Now, there has to be very, very little resistance as you move. Even a small amount, a tiny amount of resistance will eventually be too fatiguing for the wear. Now, do a Google search, and we'll have a link on the show notes, and check out the video of this thing. It's pretty amazing. One of the videos I saw showed somebody doing pull-downs with 200 pounds like it was nothing. And as a matter of fact, the test subject has been working with the suit, he does like 500 reps with 200 pounds, and he only quits because he's bored. I mean, he's not tired at all. He steps out of the suit and is like not even sweating.
So, Bob, you actually, not only do you not feel the suit there, that's kind of hugs the back of your body, right?
It, well, Yeah, I'm getting into that. The biggest initial problem for any exosuit is really to determine, you know, how is the interface going to work? That's like your initial question. All right, what's the interface going to be? Now, Iron Man uses a neural interface, and we're clearly not ready for that yet. There's another exosuit that's being popularized, and that's the HAL exosuit.
HAL 9000?
Rotate the suit, HAL.
This HAL exosuit reads minute electrical signals from the muscle, so it knows that, all right, this muscle is being activated, and it works that way. But you have to – there's a learning curve. If you step into that suit, it takes you a half hour or an hour before the suit actually learns to read you accurately enough. With the XOS, you jump into it, and bam, you're immediately using it with only 6 points of contact between you and the machine. And I love – Jacobson has a great story with how he decided to go this route as a proof of concept back in 2000. What he did was – his company had a staff photographer, and he said, could I use your daughter and you as an experiment? And he took the daughter, and you know how your daughter will stand on your shoes and you walk with you walk with your daughter. She did that. She was touching the guy's feet and his hands, and very quickly, given just a few points of contact, the feet and the hands, the pair of them were able to navigate, and he learned how to anticipate her moves. And so in that way, a smart machine could interpret – it showed that a smart machine could interpret the intended movements. So with just six points of contact, this machine knows exactly what your body's doing.
My sense is, Bob, and tell me if you agree with this, is that this type of technology really had to wait for computers to get fast enough and small enough before
absolutely.
It really was viable.
The actuators and all the subcomponents, right. That was the key. And there was some key guys in the military that realized, all right, we're now really finally at a stage where this can take off. And I think that was one of the key reasons why DARPA undertook it in 2000, because they realized there was some people were saying, you're crazy, this is science fiction comic book stuff. Why are we even going into this? But there were some people that said, no, we're really at the point now where we can make some huge progress. And so now one more bit here, what's the future of the XOS? Well, right now, they're currently working under a new two-year, $10 million Army grant. This summer, they're going to launch a new research program to develop a generator that can power the suit, because powering the suit is the biggest problem right now. Right now, it's always tethered. It's tethered to a power source. With onboard batteries, it's only got a 40-minute lifespan. That's really not much. So they're trying to really develop a generator that can get this thing going for hours at a time. But the other side of that coin is they're trying to cut power consumption by huge amounts so that it's much, much more efficient than it is right now, with a goal that Jacobson thinks they might be able to reach eventually, where it's really only using one or two horsepower as you're in walking mode, in low, minimum activity mode. It's only a couple of horsepower, which very small generators should be able to handle. The suit that he's working on now is like version 4.0, and he kind of sees this one as the base, like a base vehicle or a template that can be modified for task-specific jobs like healthcare, emergency response, war. He says future models may even operate autonomously. Imagine you can get out of it and tell it, hey, why don't you go into that building? I think it's a little too dangerous for me. You go into the building, and eventually it's a rideable robot at that point, an autonomous robot, which eventually reach.
At some point, you can totally see this coming and merging with robot technology, and really you do. You just create an army of these things.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I'll end with a quote. I'll end with a quote from Adi Granov, who's one of the main illustrators of the comic, the Iron Man comic, and he was a consultant to the film. And he watched a clip of the suit in action, and he was startled. He said, "I knew that we were heading. I knew where we were heading, but I didn't realize we were this close." Aside from the lack of flight and weapons, he adds, "That's Iron Man."
the suit is really, when you look at it, it's really not a suit, because You see the guy operating it, and this exoskeleton really is just kind of hugging his
kind of
backside of his body. So
totally
his head is completely free.
Yeah. Right, but if you think once they perfect that bare skeleton, if you will, then that's what all you need, and then from there it would be trivial to build armor around it that would be suited for the task. If you're in the military, if you're on the ground fighting, geez, wrap a Kevlar suit around it or whatever, But the exoskeleton, you know, minimalist piece that you could wrap your body around, that's what you need. And then from there, you can totally go crazy. Yeah. You can go nuts when you get that perfected.
The limiting factor, as I understand it, with having a fully armored version is just air conditioning.
That's
just
true.
Keeping cool inside a metal suit.
Yeah,
that uses up a lot of energy, actually. That's the problem that the Army's having right now, just not with exoskeletons. They're just trying to build these armor, like whole body armor, to keep soldiers safe. And that the limiting factor is that it gets hot in there really fast.
Yeah, I could imagine.
It really shouldn't even be Iron Man. It should be Alloy Man, right? I mean, it's not really iron.
Right.
No, Kevlar Man. The first suit that he made was out of iron. Gen 1. But I don't want to ruin the plot because I know Iron Man's story.
Well, the other thing, if you've seen the previews, he's flying around with the rockets coming out of his feet. And the thing that I always think of when I see things like that is, all right, where's all the fuel for this rocket? I mean, he's flying around like a jet.
That's where you really have to suspend your disbelief because that's
I mean, we've been working on jetpack technology for decades. The reason why we're not zipping to work in jetpacks is because the fuel is the limiting factor. These things have a really short range.
He would have had to have a breakthrough that is a breakthrough doesn't do the word justice. It would have to be antimatter based or something crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Chemically based? No way.
You're not. Nano engines? Not going
to
happen.
Yeah, it'd have to be something else.
But I could swallow that. I could swallow that. I just can't wait to see this movie.
Don't put down Iron Man. You're going to piss off Blackie. Don't do it.
Well, I'm just saying that's a mutual friend of ours that Jay's referring to. But I'm just saying that, Bob's right. You have to suspend your disbelief, which we happily do when we love shows like this.
Absolutely.
We love science fiction. But it's also fun to nerd out and to nitpick the science in these movies. And that's one big thing is that you can't be flying around in a suit like this because, he would have to have massive external fuel tanks, which then add to the weight and make it less efficient. And that's sort of the limiting factor that you get into unless you hypothesize some a new exotic technology and even if you grant the power, the energy source, which is part of the plot line of the movie, he would still need propellant. He would still need something to thrust out of his feet and hands to fly. And there's just no room in the suit to be carrying that amount of propellant. Well, thanks for that report, Bob.
That was fun.
All right, well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Kirsten Sanford. Kirsten, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
And Kirsten is the host of This Week in Science, a popular science podcast. She is also a fellow skeptologist.
That's right.
So why don't you tell us first about your training in science? You are actually a PhD in neurophysiology. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, so my area of, expertise is bird brains. I spent 6 years in graduate school just trying to learn about the intricacies of the way bird brains work.
But you didn't spend too much time actually doing research after you got your PhD.
Yeah. While I was in graduate school, I realized that I really enjoy being a science educator, and that's really where my passion lies. And as much as I love research, the lab is not where I need to be personally. So I had a lot of fun going out in the field and doing my own lab research and learning all sorts of stuff. But at the same time, it became really important for me to finish grad school and kind of use my PhD as credentials of credibility to be able to get myself out into the public eye and to be able to become a person that people would trust.
Right. So before you go around teaching science, you wanted to actually do some science for a while.
Yeah, exactly. Say, look, I know what I'm talking about. I've done it. I've been there. Yeah.
Well, before we talk about your media career, which I guess is just really getting started, tell us about some of the details of the specific research that you did do. Tell us about the bird brains.
Well, I was really interested in spatial learning and memory in birds, and I initially worked with a professor named Nicola Clayton, and she's now at Cambridge University. She's one of the individuals in bird brain research who was at the forefront of looking at the avian cognition as more than, more than just bird brains. So, mm-hmm. thinking that the birds can actually, their memories are probably a lot better than we give them credit for. Their intelligence is a lot higher than we give them credit for. They're very well adapted for their environments. So, and very well adapted for specialized behaviors like foraging, migration, food caching. And so I started looking at the work that she was doing in food caching and just got so interested in trying to figure out how these birds could remember so many locations of food items over the winter, be able to survive off of individual caches of food for several months. And, you know, I forget where my keys are all the time. Nicola, she used to forget where she'd leave her car. So, you know, it was kind of the, those who can't, right. Those who can't do it. And so, I worked with her on some scrub jay research, where she was looking at episodic-like memory. And so episodic memory is one of the hallmarks of human intelligence and the theory of mind, the idea that we can remember these particular events in our past history. Like, you know, you can remember, you know, the exact moment that you, say, graduated from high school or graduated from college and went to the commencement ceremony and what you were wearing and who you saw and all of the particular elements of the event that were all wrapped up in that memory. So we were looking at scrub jays as having this system of episodic-like memory where they can cache food items like a peanut or a piece of dog food or a worm and then remember days to weeks later, where they, not only where they put it, because, you know, yeah, it's good to know where it was, but also when they hit it there and what the content of the cache was. So they could discriminate whether or not they had cached a perishable worm in a location and whether or not it would be worthwhile to go back to that place to collect the item or whether they should go to another location that has a more long-lived thing like a peanut. Mm-hmm. So I started doing some work looking at less specialized species of birds, zebra finches, which are nice little happy birds that people see in bird stores all the time. And they go, meet, 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 meet. And then, you know, they sound like little squeeze toys. And these birds aren't really specialized for food caching, but they're really, they move nomadically from location to location looking for food. And so I wanted to know what kind of aspects of memory, of spatial memory, were important to them. Was color important? Was actual spatial location important? And I found that the birds were not really, you know, they didn't have the same capabilities as the scrub jays. So they're definitely adapted for different behaviors and their brains are specialized for those behaviors. Their behaviors are totally different. And so the crux of the story was these less specialized birds become more able to remember more aspects of a particular type of memory with the more experience they have with it.
Is it difficult to perform these experiments? I mean, you're not doing it out in the field.
Yeah, it's field experiments are really hard to do. And so, because you can't really control for them very well. And there aren't many people who are doing this kind of field research. Sue Healy is a researcher who's doing some really interesting work with hummingbirds, actually looking at, she puts out bird feeders that are filled with food, with nectar, and then she tracks birds going to these bird feeders and which ones they return to and which ones they don't and how long between their visits. And so she's doing some really, really cutting edge research into this that is, a lot of very, very field-based stuff. Most of my stuff was in the laboratory, very highly controlled, kind of based on psychology research in general. The birds had, they were individually housed and they had these little trays that had a bunch of possible holes in which food could be found. And so I had to train the birds to first learn to associate these trays with food. And so there was this long training period. And then you had to get the birds then to learn to flip over these little cardboard flaps, you know, that, oh, there's going to be food hidden under these things. And so there was like months of preparatory training before I actually got to the actual testing. And when I got to the testing, it was day after day after day after day. And it was, it's rigorous. And it was kind of draining.
So obviously, one of the bottom lines of all this is that birds are a lot smarter than anybody thought they were up until, you know, this research has been done over the last 10 years or so. But what's the thinking that this can teach us something about human intelligence, or did bird intelligence, is it just too far divorced evolutionarily from human intelligence at this point?
Well, I think that's the question, is trying to figure out how far apart our memories are. I was just talking with Gary Marcus, who's he studies language acquisition in children. And like we were talking about how there's this idea that humans don't really have a template inside their brain. And we just have our brain. And when we are born, language comes in through the ears. We hear people talking and eventually we figure things out and neurons fire and synapses connect in the right way. And we learn language. And that just seems a little bit strange, because in the bird world, there's a definite template for language learning. And there are definite nuclei in the brain that have been associated with the location of these templates. So birds are born almost knowing what they're supposed to say. And then it's just a matter of comparing what they hear in the outside world, but from adults, to what's already in their brain, and then developing their own use of that language. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of research suggesting that human language acquisition is very similar to that. And so these old ideas are having to be thrown out. And in terms of memory, I don't know. I think it's still wide open. And there are differences that have been found in the ways that the neurons work in the hippocampus of the birds. There could be actual molecular differences. Although the bird hippocampus, the area for the memory formation, it does have a very similar structure to the human hippocampus. We have like a three-layered structure where neuronal information comes in from like the bottom tier, and then it moves up through these two different tiers and then out to the rest of the brain. And the avian hippocampus seems to have a very similar structure.
But I want to segue to talking about more of your media career, which is what you're sort of transitioning into or doing now. And your blog post for today is actually a good way to make that segue, because you talk I suppose this is an email that you have from a parent of a 9-year-old daughter who is thanking you for the work that you have done. I suppose they're referring to This Week in Science, or I guess they could be referring to something else. But what they're talking about is that you have become a real role model for her daughter, and letting her know that it's okay for a girl to be a girl and also be smart and interested in science.
Yeah, it was an interesting comment on my blog that I got, and she said that her daughter was going through that age in which all of her friends, you know, kind of were, I don't know, I guess getting down on her a little bit. She was starting to bend to peer pressure that, you know, science is not cool and science is not something that she should be interested in, even though she was interested in it. And I just felt so special to get that note that I had actually helped to keep her daughter going. And I mean, it's something that's so important. I mean, so often there is peer pressure for girls to look good and kind of hide their smarts. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, learn about clothes and look really cute, and that's all that's important, and you're going to have to find a boy to like you. And I think it's really important to have strong female role models out there for girls who do act like girls, but at the same time aren't dumbing themselves down, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, aren't playing something that they're not, you know. It is sexy to be smart. I think that we're really getting to a point in time where women have really, it's been just over, I don't know what it's like, 60 years probably, that women have really been exposed to as many career choices as they could ever want. You know, it really has not been that long. And so we're still fighting against a lot of the stereotypes of, you know, a woman is supposed to, you know, be pretty and make the home nice. And, you know, you can be smart, but, you know, don't show it off too much. And there are a lot of things that are still endemic to our society, even though there are more and more people who are aware of it and trying to work against it. And mm-hmm. so I think it's just really important for people like me, and I know there are many, and Rebecca and many other women out there who are scientists, to actually get out there and not be afraid to wear high heels, not be afraid to play with lip gloss and, you know, act like a girl sometimes, but also not be afraid to be smart.
Yeah, you talk about the fact that there's really these sort of two stereotypes that you run into. Either you're a pretty girl who has to be ditzy or dumb, or if you're a smart girl interested in science, you have to be nerdy. And this is absolutely pervasive in the culture. You know, I have a 8-year-old daughter, and I look at the shows that she's watching, and that's what they get. The, you know, you have the gorgeous girl who's interested in nothing but fashion and becoming a movie star, and the really smart, sciencey girl is a complete nerd. Right. And that's it. Those are the only characters that exist in the television that, you know, that I'm seeing, that my daughter's being exposed to.
Yeah, and I think the Big Bang Theory is the TV show that's out there that really they do it really. The show is great. I love it, the humor. It's really well written and smart and funny, but it's a bunch of scientist guys who, they're all kind of nerdy and everything, which is, that's okay. But the two female characters that have been on the show so far is the one female character who's kind of the ditzy blonde. Mm-hmm. And then the other female character who's a scientist, and she's frazzled and she's nerdy and she's not the most, you know, she's not, you know, she's really not all that attractive in her personality or in her looks. Mm-hmm. And so it just kind of just, I watched the show and I was like, I really, really love this show, but I don't like it because of what they're doing with these stereotypes.
You know, I have a daughter that's turning 5 next month, and you know, she's really is coming on as far as asking questions, and we're learning about things together. I'm encouraging her to ask questions about all sorts of things. Actually, one of her favorite television shows, and we have a lot of these discs, is The Magic School Bus, which, you know, is a cartoon, sure, but it's geared more towards a bit of a more an older child, maybe 7 to 10 or so. However, she is fascinated with the science and what is going on in that show and everything they teach. And it is good science, and, you know, it doesn't pander to any kind of stereotypes. So I think that's a good sign for my daughter and for other kids who watch a show like that.
Yeah, that's true. At that age, because I also have a 5-year-old daughter, at that age, the educational stuff, it is definitely breaking the stereotypes, like Dora the Explorer and The Magic School Bus and other shows that are geared towards that sort of preschool age. But once you get to preteen, forget about it. All you get are these really cardboard stereotypes. It's really terrible. So just wait a couple of years, Evan. You'll see. Once they get to
I'm ready for it. I'm ready to meet that challenge with my daughter. But at the same time, I like the fact that we're sowing some good seeds here. And she won't be hopefully totally enamored with the world of glam and, you know, not pay attention to other, frankly, more important things that are going on in life.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, part of it is you can have both. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the whole thing. You know, a preteen girl does not need to be worried about all that kind of stuff. You know, they're still just kids, you know? Go outside, play in the dirt, but don't worry about being too pretty. But at the same time, you know, being glam, it's fun. And I like dressing up and I like looking fancy and being fancy occasionally. And I think that's what I'm trying to portray, is that you can be both. You can enjoy as a girl, you can enjoy the girliness of being a girl and the smartness of being a girl.
Yeah, but it's not proportional as far as what you get from media, from television, from other sources.
No.
It's, you know, it's really 95% of you know, look of women and girls looking their best as opposed to thinking their best. And I wish that would even out a little more, at least.
Yeah.
Tell us, what's your experience been like so far? So you're, you know, shifting your career into being a public, you know, educator. You're basically trying to educate the public in science. How has that been going for you? What have you been doing? And how do you think, you know, you being a woman has influenced that?
Well, it's going fairly well. I mean, I gave myself a couple of years to actually try and make a go at being a science educator, independent of any kind of big media or any outlet of that kind, and try and use the new media format to be able to get out there. It's going pretty well. I've done a lot of work I just signed with Podango, which is a podcast network to work with them because I'm really terrible at marketing and PR and advertising and all that kind of stuff. So it'll be great to work with a group who can do that for me. And then through like people I've met through the podcasting network, I've been able to get into some new video podcasts. I've done one called Food Science, which was really fun to work on. I'm not sure whether we'll be doing any more episodes or not, but it's, you know, a great show about the science that happens in the kitchen. And so it's like kind of demonstrating scientific principles using everyday objects, things that are around you all the time. And then I also am working now with Revision 3, doing a segment for their weekly show that's called Pop Siren. And on that, I do a weekly science segment, and it's kind of Mr. Wizardy, but mm-hmm. I try and keep it as, you know, I try and keep it from getting dumbed down. I try and get as much information into it as possible. And people seem to be responding pretty well, and I'm really excited about where it's going. I'm getting a pretty good positive response from people. Mm-hmm. And I think that just goes to show that what I'm doing is something that needs to be out there more.
Yeah, there's definitely a huge need for this, and especially because, you know, you have to have a combination of talents. You have to not only understand science, you know, pretty well, you also have to have the ability to explain it to people who aren't scientists. And you also have to know how to interface with media and be personable, et cetera. So it's kind of a combination of skills that I don't think enough scientists have.
Yeah.
I mean, so you either end up with like media people who don't know science, or journalists who don't understand science, or scientists who don't know how to educate or interface with the media. But to have all in one package, I think there's definitely a dearth of people like that out there.
Yeah. And I'm glad that I'm able to be able to, I'm in a place where I'm able to do this. I mean, I love talking about science. I could talk about science all day long. you know, I'm always so excited about this new study that came out or that new study. And it's just such a wonderful opportunity. And, you know, as I get out there more, I mean, I am coming across people who are like, oh, you know, you're too this or you're too that, because, you know, you can't make everybody happy all the time. And so I'm just going to try and keep an eye on, you know, what the bulk of the criticisms are, and whether or not there are lots of people kind of maybe saying the same things over and over again. And kind of if that happens to be the case, then maybe start taking that criticism seriously. Critical thinking and science are so important for the future of the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a little grand sounding, but it really is.
I absolutely agree. I mean, you know, as many of us have said and written, you know, our civilization is increasingly dominated by science and technology, and the public is increasingly scientifically illiterate, you know.
Yeah.
So something's got to break, right?
Yeah, I keep wondering, you know, you hear all these things. I was watching The Daily Show the other day, and there was this Jon Stewart gets the best quotes from people. And there was this one from, I can't remember which senator it was, but there's some senator, and he's talking about, you know, it's like I think they're talking about sex education and how it should be taught in the schools. And the senator said, oh, these people, they go to school and they study this stuff, and it's like they think they know it, and they can they know better than the parents how to teach the children,
right?
And I just like, there was some kind of disconnect in my, in my understanding of that comment.
Yeah.
Like, this does not make sense.
These people with their studying and their knowledge, they think they know stuff.
I know. You think you know something. Ah, they don't know anything.
Yeah. I mean, there definitely is an anti-intellectual undercurrent in American politics and American society, which is something else I think that we're sort of fighting against the trend.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's gotten better, though, in recent years.
Really?
I don't know, Bob.
I don't know.
It's not as, uncool to be a geek anymore. It's definitely not as uncool.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, I mean, in the political context, though, I'm quite appalled often at the lack of science and critical thinking that our politicians exhibit. You know, just take the presidential candidates, how all of them are really falling down on the whole autism and vaccines issue.
Yeah, they're really kind of following the political waves instead of looking at the actual scientific evidence.
Now, I'm interested in the fact that you chose, you said, to work the new media for your career rather than traditional media, which is obviously what we're doing as well, primarily. The reason why we did it was because, you know, the mainstream or the traditional media, I think, is too narrow in their concepts of what can and should be, you know, packaged for the masses. And skepticism is not on the short list, right? It's just not the thing that I think your average TV or newspaper executive thinks is something that would sell. So we've been able to bypass all that and go right to, you know, right to the public and build pretty substantial audiences. We're still about an order of magnitude or two below the mainstream media, but it's the lines are definitely moving in that direction, don't you think?
Yeah, I definitely think, I mean, if you look at any of the advertising any literature that's out there right now, they're all talking about how new media is becoming stronger and it's becoming a force, and more people are going online for their information. Online is the location where people can get a much broader range of subjects, and people know that now, and advertisers are going there more, and I bet in the next year or two, we're really going to see a shift in where a lot of money in the media is going to be going. So there's always going to be, you know, the place for long format programming and television, mm-hmm. or at least, you know, cable TV or whatever. As people try and get the information that they want, there's so much information out in the world and they want to find specific information. They want to listen to it or watch it or read it when they want to watch it or listen to it or read it. And they don't want to have to be tied to a timeline. You know, the internet is going to become a much more major force.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's for the skeptical movement, I think it's transformed it because, you know, we have I think the skeptical movement has probably grown by an order of magnitude or two, really, since the new media has been out there. We get emails almost daily from
That's
people
great.
Saying, yeah, I never realized that I was a skeptic. I mean, that I was part of this broader community. I've always been this way, but I didn't know that it had a name attached to it. There were other people who thought the same way, that there was a community of people, you know. So here we are.
Well, we used to have a newsletter. We'd put out a quarterly newsletter, and we had a few hundred members, and we'd send newsletters to all the members, and maybe they might pass it around to a few people. Now, every week, we've got 35,000 people listening to us, and that was just a few years ago. It was zip, so it's incredible, the leap.
That is absolutely incredible, and it's all because of the communication that's available through the internet, which I love so much. Yeah, I mean, I find that there's, you know, there's just so many more people finding things that people who maybe were in, you know, the Midwest and not in a collegiate town where they were finding more people of similar mindsets. Or, you know, there are all sorts of places that were maybe limited in the number of people that were thinking a particular way. Now they're finding these groups of people online. I think it's great.
But we're also still trying to use this as a launching pad to break into other media like television or cable. So let's talk a little bit about the skeptologists. How were you contacted for that? Or did you contact Brian?
No, Brian contacted me, mm-hmm. actually. He sent me an email and said that he thought that I should send in my information. He thought that I might be good on the show. And so I was like, okay, I'll give it a try. That sounds like fun. And then I got a phone call from Brian and Ryan, and they both they interviewed me. And then about a week later, they called up and said that I got the part, and I was pretty excited.
Now, before that, had you ever considered yourself to be a skeptic or part of like the skeptical movement, or just you were just thinking of yourself as just a science and a science educator?
I definitely think of myself as a skeptic and as a critical thinker and a scientist. But I haven't participated a lot in the skeptical movement.
You didn't think that one day you would be a skeptologist?
Yeah, no, not as such. No. Yeah. I've always just promoted that way of thinking and trying to be as skeptical as possible about things and, you know, not just accepting what, you know, comes to people on, you know, in the news or whatever.
And what's your feeling about the show?
Well, I thought it was a great group of people. It just, everyone had such amazing energy and such, you know, just positivity about the whole thing that I, it just made me really excited to think that there was a possibility to get a show out into the public, you know, to reach a much more, like a much more mass audience than any podcast does currently. I think it's very exciting. And I think the show is very well put together. I mean, I haven't seen anything other than, you know, the trailers that anybody else has seen, I don't think. But from what I saw, it was well produced, well handled. There were some great ideas going on, and there are even now like more great ideas being thrown around as to episodes that could come up if it were actually licensed by a network.
Steve, is anyone actually writing scripting episodes at this point, or just fleshing out ideas? Or
for each episode, there would be two topics. And we're just writing like a one paragraph summary of what the topic would be. It's like a pitch for that topic. It's not a script.
Oh, okay.
The show is show's unscripted anyway.
Yeah. So we just have to have the general idea and the way that we would approach all the different topics. You know, show them that this could be approached in a really exciting visual manner and not just be like, you know, some kind of boring thing. There's always a chance, and I'm just hoping that someone in a network will look favorably upon it. And I think it's going to be – I just think there's a lot of capable people putting this show together, so it's going to be a good product, and it would be fabulous.
Well, Kirsten, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being on The Skeptic's Guide. And I certainly hope that you and I have a chance to work together in the future. I hope the whole skeptologist thing works out, because it's a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. I mean, if nothing else, I mean, I have a lot of hope for this project going forward. But if nothing else, I just am so thankful for the opportunity that I got to meet you and all of the other skeptologists and the people on the crew, because it really was, you know, it was just a special group of people and just a special event. Yeah, I was very excited about it.
It was. I enjoy just hanging out with everybody. And even as you say, even if it comes to nothing, it was fun. It was a fun week, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I got to hang out with you, the Bad Astronomer, Yao Man, Michael Shermer, Mark Edwards, a magician. I mean, I never hang out with magicians. It's pretty cool.
All right, Kirsten. Good having you on the show.
Thanks.
Take care.
Thanks, Kirsten.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was nice talking with all of you. Have a great evening.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And of course, you all can play along. We do have a theme this week. The theme is alcohol.
Oh.
Which makes it all the more tragic that Rebecca couldn't play this week, but... All right, are you ready?
Ready.
Yes. Here we go.
Double boxing ready.
Item number one. A new study finds that the psychedelic effects attributed to the popular bohemian drink known as absinthe were entirely due to its alcohol content. Item number two. A new brain imaging study shows that alcohol disinhibits certain emotional centers in the brain, exaggerating the response to a perceived threat. And item number three, a new study shows that virtual reality video game environments can trigger drinking behavior and can be used to treat alcohol addiction. Okay, Jay, go first.
The new study that found that the psychedelic effects attributed to absinthe were entirely due to its alcohol content. I'm dubious about that. That would mean an awful, awful lot of hype. Okay, the new brain imaging study shows that alcohol disinhibits certain emotional centers in the brain, exaggerating the response to a perceived threat. Exaggerating the response to a perceived threat? I would say it does the exact opposite of that. Although people might get violent. That may be why people get
angry
violent
drunks.
When they drink. And then a new study shows that virtual reality video game environments can trigger drinking behavior and can be used to treat alcohol addiction. Wow, this is difficult, Steve.
Very difficult. Something about number two is rubbing me the wrong way.
The one about the alcohol exaggerating the response to a perceived threat. I think that one's incorrect.
Okay, Bob.
Well, that one, Jay, actually makes perfect sense to me.
You would
disinhibiting emotional centers and exaggerating your response. I mean, that's makes perfect sense. Maybe too perfect. The first one, psychedelic effects of. Oh, man, I read this. Ah, that really hurts when you actually saw the article and skimmed it real fast. So purely by what you say here, I'm going to say that might be science. But the one that's really rubbing me the wrong way is number three, the using video game or virtual reality environments triggering drinking behavior to treat alcohol addiction. That just doesn't sound right to me. I mean, I could see virtual reality environments used, and they have, to treat like phobias, to expose yourself to, like, say, a virtual spider and to slowly acclimate yourself to the thing. And eventually, I think it's made great strides for phobias. But an addiction like alcohol addiction, how is it? I'm not sure how a video game can do that. It's just too subtle of a thing. So I'm going to say that the video game alcohol addiction is fiction.
Okay. Evan?
About the absinthe. Jay, didn't you blog about something about absinthe a few months ago? I seem to remember that.
I sure did.
Hmm. And there's been a history of kind of, you know, misconceptions about absinthe over the years and so forth. It's kind of making a return in...
Well, it's legal now.
Yeah. Well, right. You're right. That is it. So I'm actually not surprised that that's news. That sounds like science to me, as does the brain imaging study. The problem I'm having with the video game one is that triggering drinking behavior. Is there a drinking behavior in the brain that can be triggered? I mean, it sounds a little... I'm not quite sure of the wording there, and I think that might be the curveball. So I'll agree with Bob. I think the video game one is fiction.
Okay, so you all agree that a new study finds that the psychedelic effects attributed to the popular bohemian drink known as absinthe were entirely due to its alcohol content. You all think that's science, and that is, in fact, science. Uh-huh. And that's one of those ones where if you like never heard of absinthe, you know, or what it is, you might not think anything about it, but Jay's right that there's a lot of mythology around absinthe and a lot of belief that it has these psychedelic effects.
They thought it was from the wormwood.
Yeah, there's a lot of theories about what it is. Is it some compound in it, or is it the wormwood or whatever it is? But they studied it and they found that its effects, which are actually not psychedelic, that may have thrown somebody off too, because alcohol is not a psychedelic drug. Absinthe doesn't in fact have psychedelic effects. It just has intoxicating effects that people were misinterpreting as psychedelic. Then they think that perhaps it's due to the fact that its alcohol content is 140 proof. So people are getting much more of a wallop with alcohol than they are used to.
Wow.
And that the acute intoxication, you know, is giving them an experience that they're not used to. And that was being interpreted as being like a psychedelic substance or something. And then once the mythology developed around it, you know, then that, of course, had an effect in how people interpret their experiences. But in the end, it's just alcohol. That's it. Let's see. So, Jay, you think that a new brain imaging study shows that alcohol disinhibits certain emotional centers in the brain, exaggerating the response to a perceived threat. You think that one is the fiction because you think that alcohol should have the opposite effect. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that it doesn't exaggerate responses. I think it dulls responses.
Well, that one is fiction. Ooh. So you are correct, Jay.
Ah.
And for the correct reason.
Holy.
I did reverse it. A new brain study shows that those parts of the brain that respond to threat are blunted, are diminished by alcohol. And it's interesting that you brought up, you know, alcoholics getting into fights, almost as if that would support this notion. That's actually, it makes sense the other way. The reason why people get into fights is because they're not responding to the threat, meaning that they don't perceive that it is a threat, that getting into a fight is something that would be a danger or a threat to them. Uh-huh. So they just go ahead and get into the fight. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It explains a lot.
Son of a bitch.
So it's actually, it puts you in a very defenseless position because you're not going to react to threatening situations or threatening social cues. You will not respond to them, and therefore you'll engage in behavior which will be put you at risk of being threatened. Stay in school, kids. Don't drink.
Except absinthe.
Right, except absinthe. Which means that a new study shows that virtual reality video game environments can trigger drinking behavior and can be used to treat alcohol addiction is science. Mm. So what they're doing is, as part of alcohol addiction treatment, for a while what they would do is they would tell alcoholics to imagine yourself in a scenario that typically triggers your drinking behavior, whether it's being at a bar or in a social situation or hanging out with your buddies, wherever it is that you typically drink, and in order to provoke their desire to drink. But that didn't really work. Just imagining themselves in that situation didn't really trigger the drinking behavior. So what this new study shows is that if you actually put them in a virtual reality game where, like, you know, you guys have played, we all have played these, you know, video games where you're like a character in a three-dimensional world. If you're playing like a virtual reality situation where you are in a bar, in a virtual bar, that did trigger their drinking behavior, their desire to drink. And that creates the opportunity to train them to overcome or to suppress that response, that behavior. Right? So it's like they're in a safe environment where they could virtually be in the situation where they would be at risk for drinking and then work on their response to that and their coping strategies for that. So it is being used as a tool to treat alcohol addiction.
The same exact technique is used to help people get over phobias.
That's right. So what this is showing, what a lot of recent research is all pointing in the same direction, that, you know, a sort of three-dimensional virtual reality environment can actually, you know, give us very realistic responses. We actually can behave as if we are really in that three-dimensional world and, you know, respond to it emotionally the way we would respond to the real world. And if you remember, we talked about technique they used to make somebody feel as if they were inhabiting a virtual image of themselves, sort of trick the brain into centering the self in this virtual reality self. And that could be used to make you actually feel as if you are possessing your virtual reality character in the virtual reality world.
Sounds like being John Malkovich.
Right, something like that. That's right. Very, very exciting, actually. I think, you know, in 20 years, it's going to be unbelievable, the kind of virtual reality games and simulations and other applications that we're going
to
have.
Imagine if you apply nanotechnology to that. Oh, forget about it.
We definitely have to be putting billions of dollars into this.
Bob will be there with all of his quarters. He'll pump his quarters into nanotech video game.
Evan, that is so old school. Quarters, come on.
Nano quarters.
Sacagawea dollars? What?
Nano candy.
Come on.
No, come on. You have your credit card chip in the palm of your hand. You just swipe it. Or just use some kind of biometric.
I don't know. I remember lining up the Pac-Man machine, putting your quarters up
there.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah.
Spending all day there.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
Yeah, I have a quote, Steve.
Let's have it.
This is a quote by Arthur Schopenhauer, 1788 to 1860. He was a German philosopher, best known for his work, The World as Will and Representation. So Arthur said or wrote, "Everyone takes the limits of his own vision for the limits of the world."
Arthur Schopenhauer!
What the hell was that, Jay? He walked away?
Jay, he walked out to the rafters to shout it to the world.
Well, thank you, Jay.
Very dramatic.
You don't want to comment on the quote?
It's a very cromulent quote.
Nice.
I don't know if you guys heard about this, but there's this cool event coming up about a month and a half. TAM 6. It's going to be in Vegas.
Oh, really?
I think we should go.
Tell me about that.
Well, it's a place where really cool intelligent skeptics gather. Mm-hmm. Lots of lecturing going on. Lots of things in the skeptical community that a real, true-hearted skeptic wouldn't want to miss for anything. And it's in Vegas.
Right.
And James Randi is running it, and he's cool.
And we're going to be recording live shows there. We're going to be there to chat and hobnob with our listeners. We're going to have an SGU dinner on Friday night, and Rebecca's going to hold her skeptical party Saturday night. So check out the JREF website and sign up. There's still room. We'd like to, you know, certainly have as many of our listeners there as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is the big one.
Next week is our three-year anniversary.
Jesus.
Wow.
So we're looking forward to that. It'll be a special show for us. Of course, we'll have the full boat. Rebecca will be back with us.
Great show, Steve. Thanks for having us.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.